Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. It seems like every week or every day even, the world we live in becomes more and more dangerous for each and every human and all other life forms on the face of the planet. These are deadly times, the kinds of time that demand we all stand up to change things. That's what we're facing today, and now, more than ever, we all need to grasp the danger and move on to change things. In the long term, and not all that long, we all need to fight for the future now. So, in the first half of the show, we'll be listening to a piece by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Avakian, BA, is the most important political thinker and leader in the world today. And if you're serious about saving the world and its population, you need to listen hard to what he's saying about capitalism, imperialism, the suffocation of 7 billion people, and the profound need for a world on new foundations. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing excerpts from a live stream event, America's Torture Colony, presented by Revolution Books, New York City, and demanding close Guantanamo now.
Capitalism, imperialism, the suffocation of 7 billion, and the profound need for a world on new foundations. The rulers of this country and those who represent their interests are forever boasting about the supposed freedom, initiative, and creativity that, according to them, the capitalist system and only the capitalist system makes possible, and the great wealth this has created for people in this country especially. And they continually slander communism as a repressive system where people have no freedom and their initiative and creativity is not encouraged and rewarded, but stifled and suppressed. All this is fundamentally wrong and completely upside down. First of all, the wealth that these people boast about is extremely unevenly distributed, even within this country, where a very small percentage of the people control the great bulk of the wealth. But beyond that, and more essentially, this wealth rests on a foundation of unspeakable crimes against humanity, historically and right up to the present time. To begin with, the USA is a country which established its territory and built the foundation of its wealth through the armed conquest of land, genocide, slavery, and ruthless exploitation of successive waves of immigrants to America. And today, the wealth and power of the U.S. rests on a worldwide system of imperialist exploitation, an international network of sweatshops, mines, and corporate-controlled farms that ensnares hundreds of millions and ultimately billions of people in conditions hardly better than those of slaves. This system of capitalism imperialism, a system resting on ruthless exploitation and super exploitation of masses of people, and marked by the cutthroat competition between major capitalist enterprises and financial institutions, and rivalry between capitalist states, suffocates the freedom, initiative, and creativity of billions of human beings, the great majority of the more than 7 billion people on the earth, including the huge numbers of children who are slaving away at near starvation wages, and the vast masses of people who have been uprooted from the countryside throughout the third world of Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, and are crowded into swelling shantytown slums in rapidly expanding urban areas, where most can only survive by hustling in the informal economy, legal and illegal. The freedom, creativity, and initiative of literally billions of women is suffocated and suppressed, often with extreme brutality, under this system, with the patriarchal male supremacy that is built into it. Tens of millions of people have died, and countries have been devastated in wars directly waged by rival imperialists, such as World Wars I and II, or wars in which they have backed contending local forces, all to gain or maintain control of strategic parts of the world in the bloody pursuit of key natural resources, markets, and domination of populations whose desperation leaves them vulnerable to life-stealing exploitation. Here is a snapshot of the ugly reality beneath all the grand talk about the greatness of this system of capitalism imperialism. We live in a world where large parts of humanity live in stark poverty, with 2.3 billion people lacking even rudimentary toilets or latrines, and huge numbers suffering from preventable diseases, with millions of children dying every year from these diseases and from starvation, while 150 million children in the world are forced to engage in ruthlessly exploited child labor, and the whole world economy rests on a vast network of sweatshops employing large numbers of women who are regularly subjected to sexual harassment and assault, a world where 65 million refugees have been displaced by war, poverty, persecution, and the effects of global warming. And the very future of humanity is seriously and increasingly endangered by this system, with its accelerated destruction of the environment, as well as its ever-present threat of nuclear annihilation. Within the U.S. itself, this richest of all countries, tens of millions, especially in the inner cities, are living in conditions of severe deprivation, with many denied the opportunity to find work at a living wage, or denied the opportunity to be employed at all in the regular formal economy, while they are also subjected to discrimination in education, housing, healthcare, and every other dimension of society, with all this enforced through continual police terror, punctuated repeatedly by outright murder. The current COVID-19 pandemic has both highlighted and heightened the profound inequalities in the world as a whole and within this country, as people who were already bitterly oppressed and impoverished and denied access to decent health care have been hit hardest by this pandemic. And even before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, with its crushing effects on the livelihood of masses of people, tens of millions in this country who had been regularly employed were living paycheck to paycheck, striving to provide for loved ones and hoping to provide a better future for their children, with many saddled with huge debt and only a serious health crisis away from financial ruin, while their work created wealth for a capitalist or capitalist corporation dictating the conditions of work, treating people as cogs in a machine, or in many cases, the extension of a machine, whether on an assembly line or a computer. Work that in these conditions can only be alienating and mind-numbing. In these and countless other ways, this system crushes and deadens the human spirit, as well as grinding away the life, or outright stealing the life, of billions of people in every part of the world. Think of the tremendous waste and outright destruction of human potential that results from all this. All this is the consequence of the fact that the world and the masses of humanity are forced to live under the domination of this system of capitalism imperialism. All this is the basis on which a relatively small part of the people within this country and a very small part of humanity as a whole has the conditions and the freedom to develop and apply their initiative and creativity, only to have this serve under this system to reinforce the lopsided, highly unequal, and profoundly oppressive conditions in the world as a whole and for the masses of people in the world. And all this is completely unnecessary. Revolution, the new communism, and the unleashing of human potential. Even under these conditions imposed by this outmoded, monstrous system of capitalism imperialism, creativity bursts through repeatedly in many different ways, and notably in music, literature, and other expressions of art and culture, from every part of society and every part of the world, including among those most downpressed and despised by this system and its rulers. Think of how much greater this creativity could be, and all the ways it could be unleashed to meet the needs of the masses of people, materially as well as culturally, if the ways in which billions are chained down and suffocated by this system were shattered and cast off through revolution. Through the decades of work I have carried out, drawing crucial lessons from the previous experience, positive but also negative, of the communist movement and a wide range of human experience, I have developed a more consistently scientific communist theory, the new communism, which provides the basis for leading this revolution. The methods and principles and the strategy for carrying out this revolution and, in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, a sweeping vision and concrete blueprint for a radically different and much better society on an entirely new foundation, a radically different economic system, mode of production, based not on exploiting the masses of people, but on unleashing their creativity and initiative to do away with exploitation and oppression of every kind. With this socialist mode of production, the means of production, land, raw materials, machinery and other technology, factories and other physical structures, and so on, will be publicly owned, not privately owned by capitalist exploiters, locked in chaotic and destructive competition and rivalry. This public ownership will make it possible to marshal and utilize the resources of society in a planned and flexible way to meet people's needs, both materially for food, shelter, healthcare, and so on, and culturally and intellectually in a continually expanding way, and to respond in a timely way to unforeseen developments and emergencies, while supporting the revolutionary struggle worldwide toward the goal of eliminating all exploitation and oppression everywhere with the achievement of communism throughout the world. With this mode of production, people's initiative and creativity will be encouraged and fostered, and there will be the basis for people to apply this initiative and creativity in unprecedented ways, in the interests of the masses of people, and ultimately all of humanity. Everyone will be able to work and to acquire the basis for a decent life, while contributing to the development of society on the road to overcoming exploitation, inequality, and oppression, contributing through their ideas as well as their work, without being forced into relentless competition with each other in order to survive, or striving to advance at the expense of others, a poisonous way of thinking that will be continually struggled against. It is a fundamental understanding and principle of communism, which is given great emphasis in the new communism, that people are the most important productive force, not just as producers of the social wealth, but also as conscious participants in the planning and overall development of the economy, not only for the benefit of the people in the particular country, but most fundamentally to serve the revolutionary transformation of the entire world toward the goal of communism. And the development of the socialist economy has as its source and relies upon the initiative and work, intellectual as well as physical, of the masses of people, of the members of society broadly, in conditions which are increasingly freed from relations of exploitation, and with the aim of overcoming all vestiges and aspects of such relations and the effects of such relations, not only in a particular socialist country, but everywhere on the earth. Along with and fundamentally on the basis of this radically different mode of production, there will be radically different political institutions and processes, and an ongoing struggle to transform the social relations which have embodied oppression, with the goal of abolishing and uprooting all relations of oppression as well as exploitation. There will be a radically different approach to education and culture, one which fosters and unleashes the scientific curiosity and artistic creativity of masses of people and embraces all this and enables it to contribute through many divergent paths to the advance along a broad road toward the goal of communism. There will be a radically different relation with the rest of the world, not exploiting and super exploiting people around the world, but supporting the struggle everywhere to throw off the rule of exploiters and oppressors and advance toward the goal of eliminating and uprooting all exploitation and oppression. And there will be a radically different relation with the environment, where human beings, instead of being chained to a system that plunders and destroys the rest of nature, are working together to be fit caretakers of the earth. This will be a new society aiming for a whole new world, without the suffocation, suppression, and disfiguring of the potential for the masses of humanity to understand and change the world in accordance with what are in fact the fundamental interests of humanity. To live in a world where no part of humanity is subordinated to and dictated to by another part, and where all of humanity is no longer dictated to by the fundamental workings and dynamics of a system that requires antagonistic relations among people enforced with the continual threat and use of massive violence, where the masses of humanity are no longer reduced to merely a means to make wealth for a small number who rule over them, or are cast off as surplus populations that can no longer be exploited in this way. This new society and world will not be some kind of utopia where all problems and difficulties have magically disappeared, and it will not come as a gift from some non-existent God. but will be the result of the struggle of masses of people to cast off unbearable exploitation and oppression and to transform themselves and their thinking in close interconnection with this struggle to transform their conditions. Struggle led by those who have taken up the scientific method and approach of the new communism and are winning growing numbers of people to themselves take up and apply this scientific method and approach to transforming the world in an increasingly conscious way on the basis of their voluntary initiative and cooperation. All this will involve whole new dimensions of freedom and unleashed initiative and creativity of the masses of humanity on this whole new foundation, with radically different institutions and relations among people, and radically different ways of thinking that correspond to these emancipating relations among people. Additional note: the principles and guidelines for the development of the socialist economy are extensively laid out in Article 4 of the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about capitalism, imperialism, the suffocation of 7 billion people, and the profound need for a world on new foundations. This month marks the 19th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. prison and torture camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Last week, I announced the live stream event, America's Torture Colony, presented by Revolution Books New York City and demanding close Guantanamo now. So this week, I'm going to present a couple of excerpts from the participants. They are Andy Worthington, the co-founder of Close Guantanamo. Andy is a journalist, musician, and photographer who, since 2006, has tirelessly exposed the barbarous conditions of Guantanamo and brought to public attention the stories of those who have been detained there and who died there, and the terrible conditions encountered by those released and scattered to different parts of the world. And Shelby Sullivan Bennis, the lawyer for several Guantanamo prisoners, as well as victims of U.S. drone strikes carried out outside of war zones. The first excerpt is Andy Worthington responding to a question from Raymond Latta of Revolution Books on the history of Guantanamo and the trumped-up legal arguments for maintaining this uniquely cruel prison.
I'd like to sort of pull the lens back, and given the fact that it's almost 20 years and some of the people watching this were not even born when, you know, when Guantanamo was opened. You know, Andy, I'm wondering if you could give a little more background on the actual circumstances that led to the creation of this torture colony, you know, the 9/11 attacks, how the U.S., you know, imperialists responded to that, how they saw, you know, Guantanamo, and in particular, you know, who these people were, where they were rounded up, and then one of the core elements of Guantanamo was new definitions of, you know, who a prisoner is, what a combatant is, what torture is. You know, this is a period of, you know, what was called and still is called enhanced interrogation techniques. So I think it would be helpful for our audience in terms of just some of the basics and the background and the horrible, horrific history of this you know, torture site, but, you know, some of the, what was quote unquote, motivating the creation of Guantanamo, what function it served, and how, you know, the legal system of the U.S., you know, went into action to redefine some things and to create some precedents that are still on the books and extremely dangerous. So maybe you could walk us back to sort of 9/11, you know, the quote unquote war on terror, which is actually a war for greater empire. But how did Guantanamo fit in? And especially, you know, who were the people that were rounded up, quote unquote, by whom? And what about these new categories of prisoners? I mean, both of you were speaking to that, but I think it would be good just to bring it into very sharp focus, especially for people watching who don't know that, that history. So if you could do that in a very encapsulated way, that I think would be helpful.
Okay, Raymond, yeah. Well, I began researching the prison in 2005, and in 2006, in the spring of 2006, that was when the Pentagon lost a lawsuit and had to finally provide the names and nationalities of the men it was holding. It hadn't done that for the first 4 years of the prison's existence. And something like 8,000 pages of documentation that was the unclassified allegations, summaries of evidence against the prisoners, and transcripts of the administrative hearings that had taken place at Guantanamo to assess whether or not these men were enemy combatants who could continue to be detained without having any fundamental rights. All of this was a broken process, but the information was hugely interesting to analyze. Which was what I then proceeded to do. And I spent a period of about 14 months going through these documents and working out who was who. All the supporting documentation, the transcripts would have prisoner numbers on, but not names. I mean, they don't have names. Prisoners in Guantanamo don't have names, they're numbers. But I would cross-reference the numbers to the lists that the Pentagon had made available of who was actually in Guantanamo, so that I could then come up with an assessment of who was actually there. Famously, the United States government claimed that everyone there was the worst of the worst who was seized on the battlefield. And actually, no one seems to have been seized on any battlefield. So, what I found was that a certain number of these prisoners were captured in various circumstances in Afghanistan. The largest group of prisoners were captured crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan in December 2001. So this was after a kind of showdown between Al-Qaeda and Afghan fighters and the United States, which was using Afghan fighters on the ground. And all of those people were regarded by the United States as people who had fled from this confrontation in Tora Bora, regardless of, you know, whether that was true or not, because actually the situation in Afghanistan was so horrific that all kinds of people who had ended up in Afghanistan were trying to get to Pakistan, fleeing the destruction in Afghanistan. So, you know, there were civilians there as well as missionaries who'd been, people from other countries who'd gone to Afghanistan as missionaries. Of course, there were soldiers as well. People who had been told to go to Afghanistan to support the Taliban, to create this pure Islamic state. And then suddenly 9/11 happened, and then suddenly everyone became a terrorist. And one of the great ironies of Guantanamo really is that soldiers have been treated as terrorists, whereas the handful of people at Guantanamo who are allegedly involved in any kind of terrorism haven't been charged with terrorism as a crime. So they're actually put in this strange position where they can kind of claim that they're warriors, if you like. So all the categories of everything have become very muddled. And fundamentally at the heart of it all is that still, to my mind, shocking reality that the United States set up a prison on the US naval base that it had on Guantanamo, which it had taken during the war in Cuba over 100 years ago, and now paid a lease on it for a small amount, and the lease can't be broken unless both sides agree. And that they had deliberately put a prison there because they presumed it would be beyond the reach of the courts. So that the men held would have no rights, and that the United States could do whatever it wanted to them. And when you look at that kind of position and ask yourself, what is it that they would want to do? Then you realize that what it is they would want to do is to subject these people to torture and other forms of abuse without having anybody tell them that that's not what they're allowed to do. So you've got the group of people from Afghanistan, the larger group of people crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Then you also have many dozens of people who were captured, mainly in the first half of 2002, in house raids in Pakistan, which seem to have been based on very dubious intelligence for the most part, and tie into that reference that Shelby made to President Musharraf's autobiography, where he claimed in 2006 that Pakistan had received hundreds of millions of dollars in exchange for handing over terror suspects. But some really shocking stories. I mean, literally, one man answered the door and the person that they were looking for wasn't there, so they took him instead. I mean, this is literally a case. I can't even begin to go through the cases of mistaken identity that happened in these Pakistani raids. And then the last group of people in Guantanamo, a group of about 40 prisoners, if I recall correctly, were people who were seized in other places and who had gone through the black site system, which we finally know from the Senate torture report that where we got the executive summary in 2014, that there were 119 people in this system. Actually, the Senate report didn't cover people who were held in proxy prisons on behalf of the CIA in other countries. And also, their bookkeeping was so poor that, who knows how many people they didn't even have records for. But the official figures that we have are 119 people who were at some point imprisoned in the network of black sites, torture prisons that the CIA set up in other people's countries because the United States isn't allowed to set up open torture prisons in on the US mainland. And 40 of these had also ended up at Guantanamo. So those are the people who were there. And, the releases from Guantanamo, first of all, came about because prisoners' home governments at some point faced some kind of pressure from their populations or from the media, from NGOs, eventually about what was happening to their citizens. So, European countries got their prisoners back in 2004 and 2005. The Saudis eventually got fed up with their men being held, and a large number of Saudi prisoners were sent back in George W. Bush's second term towards the end of his presidency. And then it got harder. The prisoners won this significant legal victory in 2004 when the Supreme Court ruled that they had habeas corpus rights, in other words, to ask an impartial judge why they were being held. Those rights were then taken away by Congress under George W. Bush, and it took another 4 years for them to be reinstated. But what it did lead to in 2004 was attorneys like Shelby. I mean, Shelby wasn't there at the beginning, but attorneys to be able to go to Guantanamo and for the first time to be the first people, apart from Red Cross representatives, outside of the US government, outside of the US establishment, to meet prisoners, to hear their stories, and to start to find ways to bring those stories to the outside world. And you know, as I mentioned in, you know, at the beginning when I was speaking, eventually when the prisoners secured constitutionally guaranteed habeas corpus rights in 2008 from the Supreme Court, that led to a couple of years of habeas corpus cases that went in their favor, where, you know, in around three dozen cases, the judges said, you know, to the government, we have set you a very low evidentiary hurdle here, but you have not even met it in establishing that these people were involved in any meaningful sense with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and ordered their release. And what happened then was that politically motivated judges in the appeals court in Washington, D.C. pushed back and started rewriting the rules. Eventually, you know, they started chipping away at all of the bases of assessing what purported to be the government's evidence, and eventually said that there had to be the presumption of accuracy in what was put forward by the government. Now, that's laughable when you spend any time looking at what purports to be evidence on the part of the government. But for prisoners in Guantanamo, how are they supposed to marshal any sort of case against what the government is claiming when they're stuck in Guantanamo with no facilities, with no ability to do anything meaningful to challenge the basis of their detention? And so, you know, the pushback from these judges was so successful that this period of 2 years when the law actually applied at Guantanamo ended. It ended in the summer of 2010. The final nail in its coffin came in 2011, when all of these rulings, you know, reached this point where it was clearly impossible for any prisoner to have their habeas corpus petition granted, and the law died at Guantanamo again. And this was, you know, this was during the time of President Obama. We basically saw the law die again at Guantanamo. And so this process of prisoners being released because of a political situation was something that then took over. And actually what happened under President Obama was that he faced absolutely unprincipled opposition on Guantanamo from the Republicans, who set up as many barriers as they could to him releasing prisoners. So that, you know, that was why he ended up coming up with a parole type process, that one that would shift the goalposts in terms of how prisoners were assessed so that some of them could be released. But he refused to, what I believe was possible, he refused to spend the political capital necessary to finally close Guantanamo, because, you know, he, his advisors, the administration, didn't think it was worth it. They didn't think that the amount of flak they were going to get from the Republicans was worth finishing the job and actually closing Guantanamo for good. So now, that, you know, that's why we're in this position where the law still doesn't apply. Every effort to challenge the imprisonment of these men on a legal basis has not been taken up sufficiently. You know, the Supreme Court has refused to engage with it since 2008. And of course, you know, the legacy of Donald Trump is to have left a Supreme Court that is much more right-wing than the one that that provided habeas corpus rights to the prisoners in 2004 and 2008. So this is the situation that we all need to be aware of when we're looking at Joe Biden. And I think what, you know, was very moving, as it was last year when Shelby was talking about her prisoners, is to bring this perspective from inside the prison of the hopelessness that is felt by men who are possibly but not categorically detained forever without ever having been charged or tried or convicted or anything, but that uncertainty of whether it is forever, because if it was forever, you would at least be able to possibly get your head around dealing with that. But not knowing is worse. And actually, you know, it always reminds me of a comment that was made by a man called Christophe Giraud, who worked for the International Committee of the Red Cross. And the International Committee of the Red Cross gets access to prisoners who are held in any kind of prisons that are on the edges of legality or on the edges of what is acceptable. And they had access to Guantanamo. And what they are supposed to do in exchange for this is that they don't comment critically about what's happening. But they were so appalled by Guantanamo that they actually did regularly speak publicly about it. And it was partly their interventions that helped to highlight what was going on and that helped to eventually, you know, lead to slight changes that were better for the prisoners. But in October 2003, so the prison hadn't even been opened for 2 years at this point, Christophe Giraud was asked, you know, what he was particularly troubled about at Guantanamo. And he said, what concerns us is the open-ended detention of these prisoners and the effects on their mental health. So that is what they are still facing, open-ended detention. And the effects of that are a form of torture, as Shelby said. And I think that it's very important for us to recognize that when it comes to torture at Guantanamo, those of us who've paid attention to the story over the years will know that from 2002 until 2004, when the lawyers first got into Guantanamo and pierced the veil of secrecy, there were all kinds of torture going on at Guantanamo. There were different groups of interrogators, some of whom were trying to build cases that would be lawful, and others who were basically told, given an Abu Ghraib scenario, you know, go in there, you know, mess with these people, really, really badly mess with them, keep them awake, play them loud music all night, you know, strip them naked, threaten them with dogs, all of this was happening. And yet, Guantanamo has always been a place of torture, because holding people indefinitely without charge or trial, with no notion of when, if ever, they may be released, and with no human contact at all during any of the of this imprisonment, that even if one of, even if their family members could somehow get to the naval base at Guantanamo, had the money to charter a plane to get there, they would not be allowed to see their loved ones. They would not be allowed to sit in a room with them. They would not be allowed to touch them. So Guantanamo remains this place of torture, and Joe Biden needs to close it. And what I'm hoping that we can, you know, get out to the public this year, and I'm hoping that Shelby will really want to work with me on this, because it's getting the stories of the men who are held out there. Because there are some, so there are some terrible stories that should shame all sentient, responsible Americans and other people around the world. But this is America's prison, which that are just a source of shame of these people who are, who do not constitute a threat to the United States. They are either people, as I said earlier, they are either, there are cases of mistaken identity. There are cases of people with a bad attitude. There are cases of persistent overreaction to the threat level posed by prisoners. It's there all along. If you were seized by mistake, they didn't want to admit it. When they were first administratively reviewing the prisoners' cases in the summer of 2004, they had a category that lasted for maybe a couple of weeks. It was not enemy combatants. It only lasted until lawyers looked at it and said, not enemy combatants means that we're liable for mistakes that we made. So they changed it to no longer enemy combatants. There has always been this, the basis of Guantanamo is that everybody was guilty. And that however much it is exposed that this is the biggest screaming lie in modern American history, they still managed to keep the lid on it. It really is. It really is an abominable betrayal of the truth, justice, and the law on the most colossal scale. It remains that, and it will be every day until it's finally shut.
That was Andy Worthington, journalist and activist, speaking about the legal arguments that have been developed over the past 19 years to try to justify the unspeakable cruelty of Guantanamo. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Now we'll hear from Shelby Sullivan Bennis, the lawyer for several Guantanamo prisoners, giving an overview of their present conditions.
I'm really happy and honored to be here. I think it's really important what we're doing today, and I think that Guantanamo anniversary events generally are quite important because it reminds America, and I am sure that everyone listening knows someone multiple people who don't know that Guantanamo is not closed or that people are indeed still there, and they are not actually the masterminds of 9/11 as I've heard presented to me. So what I do generally is represent Guantanamo Bay detainees, among others accused of terrorist crimes. And I represent about 8 men. I serve as legal counsel to approximately 15. And I say approximately, and it sounds silly because no person is less than a single person, so why can't I count it? And the answer is because there is actually a dearth of legal counsel for the men who remain there. And there are scarce few of us who are able and willing to do so. So of the 40 men who remain, 26 of them are low value detainees, and the other 9, as Andy mentioned, the other 17 are high value, 9 of whom are in commissions proceedings. I will not bore you with my personal trajectory as to how I wound up in this very kind of unique position in my life, in my legal career. I didn't go to law school because I believed in the efficacy of American law or the justice system, quote unquote, which I have said openly since the day I was born. It's because I don't believe in it. And I think that it's my responsibility to stand for it. And I happened to encounter a situation where in my immigration clinic, there existed a Guantanamo program in New York City, of course, under Ramzi Kassem at CUNY Law. And that kind of further opened my eyes to what I already knew was a problem, but didn't remotely comprehend the caliber of a problem that it was. And when I first got the assignment to work for people who are in Guantanamo, who are surviving Guantanamo, I reject the word living in. I thought to myself, oh, well, isn't that closing? You know, I graduated in 2015, and thus we were still under Obama's reign, and I drank the Kool-Aid I didn't realize I had drunk. And I've been there ever since, and I refuse to let go. I've changed positions in terms of employment a few times now. But the reality is that my relationship with my clients is a very unique one. It's a very personal one. There are scarce few of them who remain, and those who do, I know quite well. And to be honest, multiple things. Stage one, I am always grateful for Andy to give the overview of what's happened because I would digress in a very tedious way. So I'm happy that not only does he frankly know the history better than I do, just because he's lived it as an advocate in a very real way. But also, it's the fact that this is such an emotional topic for me, which I realize, like, as a lawyer, you're probably not supposed to be emotional, but because my job has been for several years to represent men who think they're going to die in prison, but don't quite know, which, if anyone's curious, is actually torture. It's been, like, affirmed by multiple sources and, you know, folks who define such things as being a form of torture to not know your own destination, as being so. And I engage with folks who, I don't want to overpaint the photo, but regularly consider taking their lives because they're not quite sure what their lives will be, or if they matter at all. Their contact to the outside world is limited, by which I mean so thoroughly limited that no one knows. No one knows that they're still there. None of my clients, no man who's ever been to and continues to exist in Guantanamo, has seen in person their relatives for the duration of their detention, which means 19 to 10 years, because there was basically like an influx of detainees 19 years ago, and then there was another influx about 10 years ago. And I say detainees in quotes, not just because I love air quotes, but also because, you know, the US government has chosen phrases very purposefully, as it continues to do and will continue to do for its existence. As a lawyer, I will pedantically, sorry, say that to be detained means to be temporarily stopped. Like, you know, like if you're at a checkpoint, like you're just driving around and all of a sudden there's a cop on the side of the road and they're doing like a sobriety checkpoint, whatever that is. Technically, you're detained for that very temporary period and then you're released. If y'all are from New York City or any major metropolitan area, you will probably be familiar with the fact that NYPD and others will stop you temporarily as you enter, you know, the metro system, to search your bag or just to say like, oh, hi, please give me your identification, whatever that is. That is a temporary, quote, detention. And what is really messed up, in a way that honestly I, nor I think any others know is purposeful or not, is that they've termed these people detainees, those who are detained, right? And there's been a lot of pushback from folks who are in this community to identify them as prisoners, because they're not detained. To be detained is to be temporarily held, and it also has legal ramifications, where one needn't you know, prove why you're detained. You're just detained because you're a person on the road trying to go from point A to point B, and then there's a sobriety checkpoint. The government doesn't have to actually prove itself. And that is, with technical legal exceptions, that is actually what's kind of happened here. The men there have pretty much just been rounded up. And the US and Pakistan, as like the Pakistani president has made quite clear in his autobiography, a lot of the people who are present were turned in via bounties, which is not to say that I'm trying to represent that the 40 men who remain there are complete random human beings who, you know, were turned in just because of the greed of their neighbors. But the reality is that is in very many cases the truth. And the US has very quietly affirmed that reality over the years. And what's tremendously sad is that during the Trump administration, those prisoners who feel or know that that is their reality have met a certain level of futility that I can't understand. The only thing I can understand is trying to convince someone to have hope when I can't give it to them.
That was Shelby Sullivan Bennis, the lawyer for several Guantanamo prisoners, talking about their current conditions. And I wanted to add something about this speaker, Shelby Sullivan Bennis. She is a young lawyer who has been fighting for justice for some kind of relief for the men held in the most helpless and heartless conditions and making tremendous sacrifices to do so. I really recommend watching the entire live stream event, which is now available on the Revolution Books New York City YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/RevolutionBooksNYC. Also, you can follow and support the effort to close Guantanamo on social media. I'll be putting up all the links on my Facebook page and tweeting them out. And you can sign up for news at closeguantanamo.org. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
Let's all just pray on it right now.